Okay, well, thank you very much for agreeing to come along and talk to me today.
It's my pleasure.
Could I begin by asking you about your sort of early influences on your writing and just the kind of the first sort of ideas that came to you in terms of writing?
Mm. Well, everything I read, really, or everything I listened to, every film I watched, I suppose, you know. But as a child, I had access to a lot of books, both at home and in some friends' houses. So I used to read, you know, obviously Alice in Wonderland, Alice in the Looking Glass. I mean, these are still sort of favourites, you know, really, right. You know. Classics, Hardy, Dickens, before I was really ready for them, I suppose, you know, reading the actual original versions from sort of 1920s editions and things like that, you know. So all of that, Kipling, the English classics, I had access to that, you know.
Right.
And a bit of Walter Scott as well, you know. Mm-hmm. And Stevenson, you know. So books were around me a lot. I enjoyed stories, and I used to kind of, like a lot of children do, I suppose, I used to kind of make up, like, I don't know, call them plays, but performances, and perform them on my dressing table as a stage in front of all the other kids. So I don't know what that means, but anyway, I used to enjoy making up stories, I think, from an early age, as a lot of children do, of course, and then it gets kind of squeezed out of them by life, you know, but... I lived near a disused railway line, shut by the Beeching, 62 Beeching.
Oh, right. Was this in Yorkshire?
No, this was in Scotland.
This was in Scotland.
Yes. So I used to play on this railway line. Well, I mean, there were no rails anymore, you know, but some of the sleepers were still there and the whole ambience and so on. And, you know, we used to play there. And that was, now looking back on it, it was a kind of cutting, so nobody could see you. Now you think about it, you would never let your kids play there.
You're quite dangerous.
Now. But in those days, there was no danger, you know.
Right.
I mean, really,
yeah.
There was no... And so, you know, we used to play there. And that kind of thing, I was near the countryside. I was always on the cusp between the town and the countryside, wherever I lived, you know. And I lived in an English village for a while as well. We went back to England for a while.
I see.
You know, so there was that. I had exposure to that as well as the city. So all of these stimuli, looking back, probably did feed into my writing and triggered things, you know.
Are there particular elements of your childhood that you can kind of see in your own writing? Is there anything that you're carrying on?
The passage of time, history, loss, all of that, of course, you know, human things, you know.
Yeah.
You know, changing landscape, places where you've lived as a child have changed now, you know, buildings have been demolished.
Right.
You know, the whole landscape has been changed. You know, hills have gone, you know, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
For example, the village we used to live in Lincolnshire used to be a real village, you know, with self-sufficient, you know.
Mm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, and buses, nobody had cars. The vicar had a car and the farmer, and that was
right.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the doctor, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else had bikes or used to go on buses, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a completely different... And that was... We're talking about the late 60s, early 70s. We're not talking about the 19th century here.
Yes,
we're not talking Cecil Sharp, you know? You know?
It's not really that long ago.
Yeah, no, it's not long ago. Yeah. And yet the life was completely different and people really did grow their own, and even the local produce came from the county, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So now it's Commuterville. It's Commuterville for Lincoln and Scunthorpe and Sheffield and the four-wheel drives, and the whole thing has completely changed.
Different,
completely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there were no buses. I mean, bus service was cut, you know, and so on and so forth. So that kind of thing, you know, I draw on that kind of change and history. There were a lot of disused aerodromes around there from World War II, you know, and then, of course, up here in Glasgow, and I used to live on the edge of Renfrewshire, you know, between Paisley and Barrhead, and so there was this railway line and fields and stuff, and then gradually it got built up, you know, and we used to live in the grounds of a psychiatric hospital because my father was a psychiatrist, so that was interesting because there were people in. Now looking back, I know that there were people there who'd been there since they were young because they'd been put there because they had an illegitimate child or something in the 20s.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
For awful reasons.
So I imagine they would be there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I didn't know who they were at the time, but, you know, lots of elderly at that time used to wander around the woods, you know, and you know, of this vast sort of estate where the psychiatric hospital sat,
well,
you know.
Glasgow used to build them on quite a grand
Absolutely,
scale.
That was the whole point. It was asylum, you see, this idea of asylum that you went there and you got, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I think we've lost that.
Mm.
So, I mean, a lot of bad things that happened, but they've thrown out the baby with the bathwater.
I think a lot of them are luxury flats now.
Yeah, that's right.
Converted the buildings into...
They have, they've sold them off, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
So that there were all these people wandering through that were kind of inverted commas mad, you know, do you know what I mean, in the sort of broader sense, you know.
Labelled that way.
That's right, they were labelled that way. Yeah. And so, and some of them did jobs, in the, they were the paperman. Paperman was an ex-patient who still lived there because he'd been institutionalised. You know, the van man, you know, the van driver and the gardener, and they were all, they would all, so, and they used to grow these vegetables and things and look after these parrots that used to talk. At least to sort of bark expletives, because that's what they told them. So you went, and this minor bird would swear in blue language at you, kind of, at these very proper ladies that used to get. So it was that I was exposed to all this kind of madness, if you like, you know, in the madness in the kind of broadest literary sense of the word, as well as in the literal sense, you know, the clinical sense. So looking back, that was actually quite a stimulating atmosphere for a kid to be brought up in, quite an unusual atmosphere, actually, you know. And then the stories of the people that used to work there. You know, stories from the Second World War that they wanted to do something, but because of the war, they couldn't. That was that happened a lot, you know.
Right.
So they had to accept a lower sort of level of career, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you know, all of this stuff, and just the attitudes that used to pertain then, like divorced women were bad, you know. That was the attitude. Working women were bad. That was the attitude.
Well,
you know, if women worked, they weren't looking after their kids. And so this was in the 1960s Glasgow, you know.
Yeah.
So as a kid, you would get all these vibes from, you know, from the elders and from people around you, and so on, and so societal change. You draw on that when you write, you know. Whether you like it or not, it comes into your characters, you know, if they're old enough to, you know. So history and geography is really what I'm saying. Time and place, you know, are what have influenced me. And then, of course, I was exposed to music of various different kinds. Mm-hmm. My father had a reel-to-reel tape recorder. With a valve one, with one of those lovely green lights that used to flicker, you know, used to hypnotic green lights, and they used to warm up. And at the time, it was fairly state of the art, you know. And Philips, of course, and he had this massive great tape that he used to put on songs from India and Pakistan from the 50s and 60s, film songs, you know. And used to play these. He had a couple of them, actually. Used to play these all the time, you know. And so I was exposed to all these songs, you know, which at the time were hits or recent hits, you know. And so from what became classic films, because that was the classic period of filmmaking in India and Pakistan, both. The period from during the 40s, 50s, 60s and into the 70s, where the best films were made, which even people now recognise that, you know, where there was some kind of symbiotic thing between lyricists who were poets, musicians, dancers, actors, directors. And we're talking about accessible populist films here, but they were artistic and they strived for excellence. And they did. They were excellent. If you watch the dancing, it's better than it is now, you know, in terms of its artistic merit, you know, it's striving for excellence and it's not a slave to the beat, you know. So I was exposed to all that stuff, as well as more sort of overtly popular songs. And so, and of course, my elder siblings used to listen to 60s music. Looking back now, it was Radio Caroline, I remember that, and also then Radio 1, you know.
The pilot station.
I remember all that. So they used to listen to this all the time, and maybe Radio Luxembourg on little transistor radios that used to have, you know, next to their desk as they studied, you know. And so I don't remember the songs now, but I except very vaguely, maybe the Beatles and stuff, you know, I do remember that. But looking back, they were probably listening to the hits, but also sort of psychedelic stuff from John Peel. It must have been John Peel's Top Gear, Perfume Garden. Looking back, my brother probably listened to that stuff. And so as a sort of 5-year-old, you know, or whatever I was kind of exposed to all this. And now looking back, that was a great sort of environment to be, you know, because, you know, and then the sort of voices around me, you know, when we moved up from England, the voices in Glasgow are very different, you know. And so, you know, my elder siblings spoke in Yorkshire accents, of course, because they were teenagers and they'd already been, you know. By that time in their mid-teens. And so it was a different exposure, you know, again. So there was that. And then there was TV, of course, which we had. And on TV, it was BBC Voices, you know, because it was basically BBC One and ITV.
Right.
BBC Two opened up. Had just opened up, I think, and they only opened for a certain time during the morning, I think. And so all of that, and that gradually, and we had a black and white TV for a long time. So all of these influences, I mean, I'm kind of rambling on, but it is a kind of rambling story, really, you know.
It's one of the things that I liked about Psychorag, that, you know, when you mentioned the music before, that there are all these different sort of genres and times that are coming into it. And like you said, the music from the films still seems to be very sort of popular. I mean, I don't know much about, you know, the sort of typical kind of Asian radio station choices, but I mean, is that typical that people listen to a sort of wide, you know, range of music from different times?
I mean, in the sense that they would listen to music from South Asia or from the diaspora of a broad period, then that's true, or at least that there would be listeners for that. For that, they might not be the same people, of course, just any more than people that listen to Radio 1 also listen to Radio 3. I mean, there will be people that listen to both, but, you know, they're targeted at different markets, aren't they, broadly speaking, you know. So in a similar way, on a South Asian radio station, they will have, you know, programming for, I suppose, aimed at an older age group, you know, people that moved from South Asia a long time ago, and they'll play, you know, older songs, and then they'll play sort of more modern songs for the younger people. But at the same time, you know, when I speak to people, young people, you know, when I've been interviewed, for example, on South Asian radio stations, they've when I've talked about the older songs, they say, "Oh yeah, we love that," you know, from 71 or something, you know, so really sort of before they were born, you know. So, you know, those songs do still get played a lot in their houses, and they're aware of the ambience. You know, films get remade, you know, a lot, just as they do here. There's a tendency to remake films, and so people then, you know, everybody then knows it's been remade, and they'll go and see the older film, and even if they haven't seen it before, and their parents will have watched it for definite, you know. So, you know, I think they are, a lot of them are exposed to the older stuff, which is a good thing, you know. You know, because a lot of them are on videos now and DVDs and stuff like that. So, and when they go back to Pakistan and India, they'll be there, sort of wall to wall, you know, literally sort of wall to wall screens and things, and they'll be watching it, you know. So, yeah, so there's a broad level of range of exposure in terms of time. I think. Though it's quite unusual, perhaps, to get someone that would be into as many genre music from as many different cultures as I'm into. Although there are people, of course, you know, but but you know, you'll get people, I think, that are into world music. You know, kind of educated people. You know, young people into world music and into current South Asian music and crossovers and all that. But they're unlikely, in general, to be into psychedelic British music from the 60s and beat groups from the 60s, for example. Although there are people who are, I know one who is into that, you know, having said that, and he always pleasantly surprised, you know, and so on. But, you know, I think that's quite unusual. But at the same time, what I wanted to do in Psychorag and in some of the other writing that I do is seek out the common streams that are flowing through all of this music. Because there are common streams, of course. I mean, groups like the Beatles and other groups in the 60s explored these areas. And not just superficially. I mean, think about George Harrison for the rest of his life, basically, you know. And so, you know, I think it's important to kind of link up that period, you know, where to a small extent, perhaps in London at least, you know, some people sort of forgot that they were sort of British, inverted commas, and grey and sort of post-war and became something different for a while. And no matter how superficial that might have been, it wasn't for everybody, and some of them became much more deeply involved and it lasted and it changed them, it changed their lives, you know. And it had ripple effects. You know, society did change as a result of that period, actually, quite fundamentally, in my view. Not in all the ways it could have done, but in some, you know, cultural ways and so on. So, you know, I do think that, and I think also that a key point about that period is that it linked up with politics, which I think now doesn't seem to happen so much. You know, I think, in a way, it's a pity, you know, that you know, where are the rock groups that are singing about Iraq, the big rock groups, the popular, the top rock, you know, the ones that get into the living rooms of ordinary boys and girls, you know, the girl groups. Where are the songs protesting about, you know?
Where are the protesters?
Well, exactly, you know, so do you know what I mean? So it's become corporate. And I think, you know, there was a period when that did happen, and that did, was significant, you know? And so, I mean, you had bands that were involved with the White Panther movement in the US, you know, which was equivalent to the Black Panthers, you know, for example, and Black Panther movement. I mean, you know, and all that stuff, you know? You know, and it was of its time, but I kind of like to link into that because it takes you further back then, because those people were influenced by older streams, you know, blues, slavery, all that stuff, stuff from, you know, the early part of the century, you know, the socialism, you know, all of that stuff. And it kind of triggered the Green Movement, didn't it? I mean, right. that's another very important thing.
You can see that sort of link going all the way back to history.
Totally. And that linked into kind of, you know, indigenous movements in the US, the Native American movement, black movements in the US and the UK. And also it drew on sort of Indian stuff, didn't it? I mean, the ecology, the whole ecology, that whole different view of the universe, you know, from Eastern religion, from Hinduism and Buddhism, that they drew on very heavily. And then Sufism as well.
And some the West of them has got more interested really in Eastern religion.
I think so, in a way that was deeper than before, that was perhaps less imperialist than before, you know?
Right, yes. Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's very significant. And I think it's something that's ignored to their own loss by maybe current South Asian, you know, radio stations and youth and so on.
Yeah.
Largely because they haven't been exposed to it. And so this is part of my thing to link all this together in some sort of seamless narrative, you know, galvanised by the music, you know.
Yeah.
And because if you think about the origins of rock music, where did it come from? It came from West Africa, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some people argue that jazz music, which was formed in New Orleans, of course, from a confluence of basically African music, Latin music, and, you know, white settler music, basically.
Yeah.
The whole thing came together and it became jazz. There's an argument that I've read somewhere that said that actually that confluence came together before, to some extent, in North and West Africa during the kind of Iberian Moorish thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting argument, and I've seen it. And of course, there are rhythms in Latin America, in Brazil, which are actually Arab rhythms because they went with the Spanish people, the Portuguese, you know? So. I see music as a great, you know, liquefying element, you know, that you can kind of seek out stream. Not construct artificial, you know, politically correct, you know, but, you know, things. But actually dig deep.
It's a genuine history.
Yeah. There. Geologically almost, you know, and sort of dig down and, you know, this kind of Kenneth White's idea of, you know, geopoetics, you know, sort of dig down into the strata and the deeper you get metaphysically. And also in terms of time, and I try to do that with my writing as well, which is why it kind of spirals down. You probably noticed it spirals down, one thing leading to another, you know, until you hit bedrock, which is maybe a paradox. And then paradox can be a key to structural symbolic meaning, as they say. You know, you can see it's like a mirror, isn't it? You can kind of pass through it into another view of things. So music is a good way of doing that. And so I don't remember where this where we started with this question, but that's an example, you know.
Yeah.
But
With Sakurag, I mean, one of the other questions I wanted to ask is that I was very interested in almost the kind of archetypal role of some of the different characters.
Yeah.
You know, that Zilla seems to be such a kind of force of nature, almost a sort of chaotic kind of influence. And yet you can see how Zafar is still quite interested in her.
Yeah.
You know, he's still sort of, she's got a kind of enchanting quality in a way for him. She seems to retain that. And I wondered, you know, if she was... Is she more than just a character? You know, is she sort of, does she kind of symbolize something for him?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the problems with Sakurag that I saw was that the female characters in it were a bit too, you know, like ciphers, you know, to some extent. And some of the other stories in The Burning Mirror, they're not.
I suppose that there's a kind of sort of opposition between the very sort of wholesome Babs on the one side and the kind of, you know, chaotic, dangerous Zilla on the other side.
So. You know, and I kind of toyed with that and worried about it, actually, you know, and still do to some extent, you know, because what am I saying here, you know? But at the same time, I mean, Babs, Barbara, Barbie doll, and Zilla, somebody said it's Godzilla, but I hadn't thought of that when I wrote it, actually. But Zilla has a meaning. It's an old, it's actually an old Hebrew name, but it's also an Arabic name, and it means something, and I've forgotten what the meaning was. But I knew when I wrote it, and it's deeply significant. And someone could write an essay about it. Anyway, but it does mean something, and it's relevant. You could look it up. In fact, I'll look it up when I go home, and you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it means something. And Zilla is a kind of... I wanted to look at what happens with Zilla and also with Zaf's father.
Mm-hmm.
What happens
mm-hmm.
when the dream doesn't happen? You know, what happens when you don't make it? What happens when you implode?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
What happens when you go down a very dark pathway, a diabolic pathway, and self harm and all, which is what she's doing.
Yes.
Very powerful, but she's gone. And yet she still does have a magnetism. She's almost vampiric. Actually, she becomes a sort of vampiric character, doesn't she?
It's almost like she comes and sort of steals his energy at that point.
Yeah. She's
kind of invades the studio.
And then there's an issue of, you know, misogyny and vampires and all that stuff, and I'm aware of all that, you know.
I wondered if there was a sense...
And it's a male viewpoint.
Right,
this novel is from a very male viewpoint. And I wanted to expose that, warts and all, and not apologise for it, and not kind of resolve it.
Right.
You know, not say this guy's now a balanced, politically correct individual who's kind of, you know, I want you to make him as horrendous as he could be in his mind.
Right, yeah.
You know, and that was a way of doing it, you know. And but interestingly enough, just a small diversion, stop me when I...
Oh, sure.
You know, that one of the other characters in it, who's a supporting character in it, who's, I think, Ruby, I think.
Ruby, yeah. Uh-huh.
She was... potentially a powerful character. I think Zaf hints at that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
That she's not been destroyed.
Well, again, she's got that kind of sort of mystic hold over him in some way.
She has. And I wanted to have that possibility, you see. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to have, you know, this Asian woman who's become a kind of druggie, you know.
Right,
all that.
Yeah,
uh-huh. And that was the only... Yeah. And I thought there's got to be other things. And so she became this sort of stronger character. But if she had become more prominent, she would have become a major character, and that would have upset the balance of the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually... she drove a story which she appeared in The Burning Mirror, The Queens of Govan.
Yes,
she's the character. She is the character in that, actually.
Yeah.
So she demanded that story, which is why it's a kind of, I suppose, a feminist story, really, The Queens of Govan, which it is, I think. You know, it takes it's a female bonding story.
And she's quite powerful.
She is, she is. Mm. So that was a kind of riposte, in a way, you know.
Yeah.
And you could view it as part of Psychorag, but it's a kind of outtake, you know, which has become a story in another book. But
I did sort of wonder, you know, if Zafar is almost sort of being pulled in two different directions by these two different people, you know, that the, there's a sort of, you know, maybe wilder side to him that he's quite attracted to sometimes.
Totally, yeah.
But there's also something more sort of stable and reliable that... I think maybe, you know, the more sort of sensible parts of him are drawn to.
I think you're right. And there's also the kind of theme of acceptance into white society, which is partly why he goes with Babs, you know, because she's a kind of, you know, and she's a nurse, isn't she?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is significant. She's a nurse, you know, kind of mother god or something.
Nurturing,
mother goddess, kind of, you know, all that. Whereas the other one's Kali, of course, it's a kind of idea of this kind of goddess with different faces, isn't it? And one's kind of the lover goddess, you know, all that stuff.
I thought it worked quite well, really, in terms of, you know, that this was his sort of one long evening, and when you learn that, you know, he's been awake for such a long time in the course of this evening, that, you know, that it's a bit like when, you know, when you have had lack of sleep, you know, and things start to take on slightly more kind of metaphorical...
They do, don't they? And you start to derealise, don't you? Mm. Things become a little less real or hyper-real, perhaps, you know, and if you had too much... Well, he's had a lot more than coffee, but if you... clearly, you know, but if you had even too much coffee, and you'll start to kind of, you know, think, I thought somebody said something there and they didn't, you know, and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I liked, though. I wanted to drive him to a liminal state,
mm-hmm.
you know, where he, and also the reader, doesn't quite know whether it's real or whether it's not, but not quite cross that boundary. I don't really walk into magic realism, but it's hovering there, isn't it? And it's kind of,
There are certainly points where I was reading it, where I was sort of thinking, well, you know, is this the present time? Is this him remembering something? Is this him thinking how he'd like something to be? Or, you know, especially the part where Zilla comes and sort of attacks him, more or less. And there are bits of that where I was sort of thinking, you know, is this how he envisages it?
Exactly,
or is this how she actually does it?
Sure, are you? Yeah, and that's the whole thing. I mean,
and I like that ambiguity. Yeah. I think it works better.
Did you?
Well.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And I also wanted to oppose this intense physicality, because it is. I mean, it's almost pornographic in its kind of depiction.
Yeah.
You know,
it's very physical.
It is very physical. Yeah. And with this kind of more metaphysical song thing that's Stravinsky that's going on in the background, you know, you know, and that's another thing. I mean, if you think about films like Performance, you know, the James Fox Mick Jagger film, that kind of thing, which that kind of film, or even Vanilla Sky, more recently, the Spanish version, or the American version, that I like that kind of possibility of something else happening, you know, and of weird things happening, and so that there is that, and also people splitting into two, you know, or more, you know, and doing something in one, and that's Joyce, isn't it? I mean, in a way, you know, Molly Bloom and all that stuff, and that's another. I mean, going back to influences, I mean, you know, I kind of read some of the canon and stuff and drew on it all, really. But I prefer, you know, stuff like, you know, I do Joyce and Virginia Woolf and, you know, Juan Rulfo, a Mexican writer, sort of godfather of magic realism, before Marquez, actually. Mm. Marquez actually drew on him. Calvino, you know, Gustav Meyrink from, you know, the Prague, you know. All kinds of weird writing. I mean, I've read, you know, Middlemarch is a great... it's the quintessence of that kind of English novel.
Right.
And I think it's a wonderful novel.
And yet you've got the sort of Casbah characters with their own.
Well, I mean, I feel
well.
Very much like, I feel sometimes like a mixture of Lydgate and Casbah constantly, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes, you know, so that's, but so I draw on that as well, you know, and so I think juxtaposing all that, you know, together with stuff that I've read from South Asian translation as well, you know, like Manto Hassan, Sadat Hassan Manto, who's probably the greatest short story writer in South Asia, dead now, sort of mid-20th century, pre- and post-partition.
Right.
And, you know, more recent ones like Anita Desai and all of these people. You know, obviously I've read books from a lot of them anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. I've read Rushdie as well. You know, I've read him, but I'm not consciously influenced by him. Mm-hmm. Maybe subconsciously.
Because you've been compared to him in some
That's right,
views.
That's right, I have. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. what I've deliberately... It's not me anyway. I've deliberately eschewed is that kind of upper class Oxbridge way he kind of writes, looking down at his nose at people, you know. Mm-hmm. And I really that puts gets my goat up. That kind of you know, it damages his writing. I think.
Right.
Yeah. I think his best writing is when he doesn't do that. When he lets go. Mm-hmm. When he lets fly. You know.
Yeah.
His stuff in Shalimar, the clown about Kashmir, was very moving, and it was very moving because he forgot that he was an upper-class English twat, basically. And you can put that into the... I don't mind, you know, I've said it in reviews of
right,
this book, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
Well, in a different way. Yeah. But
I suppose that's true of quite a lot of writers, that there's an element of sort of contriveness that they sometimes use that doesn't really help, and when they stop...
I think so.
You know, sort of put all the baggage to one side and just do it.
I think some writers are hidebound by the class that they have assumed or that they've been born into,
right.
And it stops them.
Or they feel they have to represent themselves.
They've looked so long through these specs that they can't look through anything. It's become lenses and they can't look through anything else anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And they've never had an experience, I think, possibly, which would allow them to tap into anything different, you know?
Right.
And it's almost like programming. I mean, it seems that way anyway, the way that they were. So I'm always keen, on the other hand, to try recognizing that I'm a limited being, as being a man, you know, in the 21st century, in this, you know, whatever, you know, as we're all limited. At the same time, I try to step into different psyches with everything that I write.
Yeah.
So that's evident in The Burning Mirror, I think, you know, it comes out, you know, the stories in The Burning Mirror. And what I'm writing now is quite different from Psycharag, and it's from a female point of view, and it's quite different, slow-paced, different.
So you were talking about the ideas of characters and the different sort of roles that they took on. I think that was where we'd left off.
Yeah, that's right. It's almost like, I suppose, method acting in a way that when you're writing, you know, you're doing it vicariously, okay, but you're really trying to get yourself into the physical being almost of a character, you know, and the thought patterns and the whole thing. And that only happens through the act of writing. I mean, you can't just imagine it, you know, it's got to really, you've got to actually be typing away or whatever you do, you know. Because one thing leads to another. I mean, in the linear sense, but also in the character building sense, because they build themselves. You know, it just occurs to you. You know, and so I think there must be some subconscious thing going on that you're constructing a character and you don't know you've constructed it yet. And, you know, this kind of thing.
Do you feel as if the characters almost sort of come to you? You know, that
sometimes
they sort of tell you how they want to be.
Well, if it's working, they do. You know, if the story's working, or if the part of the story's working, then they do. You know, and. Like, if you're writing a novel, then, of course, they begin to do that, and that's brilliant, you know. And often they'll find ways out of things that you're stuck in an impasse, you know. You're not quite sure where you're going, where you go next, and something will just occur like that, because you've been thinking about it as you do your shopping or whatever, without thinking about it, you know.
There's a lot of subconscious.
There's a lot of subconscious stuff goes on, and I always scribble things down in notebooks and things and ideas, and probably won't use some of them, but that's fine. You know, so characters, and then other characters behave in ways that you don't realise that they would have behaved, and divert your main characters and stuff like this. You know, people sort of decide to die. You know, it's like, oh, hang on, okay. You know, and then you've got to watch. It doesn't become a Lorca thing, and then sort of everybody dies.
Because
very tempting. Anyway, but so in the context of different voices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I obviously kind of read, you know, more recently read people like Kelman and so on, you know, contemporary Scottish writers and so on, from working class origins, who have kind of writing in that voice, those voices, and found that very powerful music, you know, and that sort of, in a sense, galvanised my writing in urban realist Scottish parlance, you know.
Right.
So
Do you feel that you draw on those authors or on them as well as people that you've met or, you know?
But both, I think. I mean, I'm drawing on people that I've met, and obviously the voices mm-hmm. that are in my head from listening to people talking, you know, and my day job as a doctor, obviously, I encounter all the different social classes and all kinds of extreme situations of intoxication, you know, all kinds of things. Yeah. So, you know, you really get, you know, the whole gamut, you know, mm-hmm. And that's good for a writer, I think, you know, because you've got access to those voices, right. I think, you know. And obviously I grew up, you know, among different social, a variety of social classes, you know, I wasn't, you know, closeted in that way. So, you know, which was, looking back, that was actually good for me, you know, because you could become very, very specialised, especially in the modern economy, you tend to become very specialised, you know, you know, sort of angel on the head of a pin type of thing, and you become specialist about that particular pin, you know, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And not just in, I mean, academia, you know, but in everything, you know, and we're sort of almost driven towards that, aren't we, you know, in all walks of life, actually. So it's quite good to be a generalist, you know, the generalist has gone out of fashion, but actually I quite like the generalist idea, you know, that kind of, almost kind of 18th, 19th century idea that you would be lots of things, and explore, you know, the genealogy of leaf forms at the same time as being a kind of cosmonaut or something. Do you know what I mean? You know, I see myself as a generalist, actually, and I think that's what I draw on. I draw on this very broad canvas. It's very broad, you know, and then I kind of try to go deep by doing research and by kind of reading factual books and reading fictional books and reading poetry around what I'm writing.
Right.
So all these different voices pour into my head, you know, from different places and times and so on and points of view. And then I hope that what comes out, I'm quite an organic writer, so I really start from a point of energy and then go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think about structure and stuff, particularly in novels more than short stories, but, you know, because you kind of have to, obviously, you know, before I start, you know, and I have this mind map that I have this idea of where the novel might go in terms of spatial terms, you know, where are the characters going to go, you know, physically.
Mm-hmm.
It might not work out like that, but that's what I have. But it's quite vague. I really don't know what is going to happen to those characters, how they're going to resolve, if they're going to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the fun of it for me, of novel writing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I you know, read as and I do research as I write, as well as doing it beforehand. And I continually do that. And then as it goes through draft, I do some more research, and I kind of... It's layered.
Right.
It's a layered thing, you know? It's a, if I can use a musical parallel, it's and without being sounding grandiose, but... It's more like Beethoven used to do it. You know, Beethoven used to bash it down.
Mm.
Presumably, you know, he had some ideas and he bashed them down.
Mm-hmm.
And then he used to go over it and 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 layer it till it was perfect or as near as you could get.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Mozart didn't. He just kind of allegedly had it in his head and bashed it down and it was perfect.
Mm.
So that was him, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm much more of that, the former kind that, you know, I like layering it because I think it acquires a different levels then, and you're a different person when you come to the end of it from when you began it, because you're kind of half mad, you know, but also, you know, it may span years. I mean, this Psychorag spanned 5 years of my life, although I didn't only do that, thankfully. But, you know, I was a different writer at the end of it, you know, partly because I'd written other things.
Yeah, and time is such an issue, really, in that book as well, with the whole sort of...
Of course.
It's almost a sort of cosmic journey of his parents coming over from Pakistan. And you know, their sort of, you know, adventures along the way, and yet it's all in the course of one evening.
It is. Well, that's the compression effect. I wanted a pressure cooker effect.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted all this 60 years of history distilled into a single 6-hour period in one man's head.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what would give it the kind of frisson and the drive and the dramatic tension, if you like. You know, the kind because it is a stage, really, in a sense. Well, he is performing. I mean, he's broadcasting.
Yeah.
And so. You know,
it's almost like he's going through some kind of, you know, overnight sort of maturation process himself.
Yeah,
that he's digesting all this stuff. And
I think so.
All this history is coming back to him because of the, you know, the different things that have happened to him leading up to that night.
Yeah, which are coming together or falling apart in his life. You know, it's the dark night of the soul. And you're right, and it's through the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was my point. The music was, if there's any redemption, it was through this music, this stream of linkages across different cultures and different times.
Right.
You see, and across. Getting out of reality in some way, you know.
Something's being created, although things for him are breaking down.
That's right.
I suppose.
Absolutely. So he's drawing on all these different voices that I've talked about, you know. And in a way, it was a kind of license for me to kind of explore all of that as well. You know, there was a bit of there was a bit of indulgence going on, I think.
Mm.
But Zaf's very self-indulgent. He's irritatingly self-indulgent, actually. At points in the novel, you've got to get yourself together. And, you know, slap, slap, slap. You
think
know.
About somebody else for a while.
Yes. You know, so it's like that. But that's the way kind of he is at that point, I suppose, and it enables him to do that, and hopefully carry readers with him into places where they might not otherwise have gone. You know.
Mm-hmm. I think his state of mind sort of justifies a bit of self-examination.
I think
well.
So, yeah. So yeah, yeah, yeah. You know,
it doesn't jar, I don't think.
No, yeah. And there is that Mill Modlin thing, you know, that you know, that, as well, you know. So, yeah. You know, in a sense, he sort of deserves to get sort of beaten up when he does. You know, maybe that's his guilt, you know, but that's his guilt, isn't it? I mean, he's guilty about Zilla, isn't he? He's terribly guilty about introducing her to drugs and then abandoning her and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, moving on to this white woman, you know, who'll give him, you know, and she's sort of left there in the kind of festering, almost mythical East End of Glasgow, you know, where she's kind of holed up somewhere, you know, on this awful street, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's very powerful, actually, that whole sort of image of her kind of wasting away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not quite knowing where she is, or even if she's alive. You know, she's almost like a ghost sometimes in his memories.
So. She's becomes like that almost at the end, doesn't it? And there's this kind of street. I read a book for my O-levels years ago, you know, called The Child of the Jago, set in a kind of London-like place in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like Oliver, but it was far darker than Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Jago was the worst street in the worst area of the worst part of the worst city. You know, it was like that, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, it obviously the enlightened English teacher that taught us this book must have realized that there were parallels between that and Glasgow, mythically speaking, and reality too, you know. I mean, obviously. So, and the way they've been portrayed over the years and so on and so forth, and so that stuck in my mind actually from sort of 1977, you know, and I don't know who wrote it, I'll need to look it up on the web, but that kind of idea of this vortex where the centre is the most festering place on earth, you know, almost, you know, and where there's no hope, you know, and generations of no hope, and of course, there are streets like that in every city, of course, in the world, you know, and Glasgow's no exception, and and without kind of totemizing it into this mean place, you know, there is that, you know, and I wanted to kind of, what would happen if somebody kind of gravitated towards that and you know, and didn't move out into the suburbs and become bourgeois, you know, which is the aim of the immigrants and all that,
right?
You know, upwardly mobile stuff, which is fine. But what happens if that didn't happen to you, you know, and you got on the wrong roundabout?
How far can you fall, I suppose?
Exactly, you went. And Zaf's father is also, I'd wanted to portray this man as a fragile person with hopes and dreams that collapsed. And that's why I made him work in the sewers, because I thought, what's the most potentially degrading job that you could think about having is working in the sewers underground in the darkness, you know, all that.
And the whole sort of, you know, his whole sort of metaphorical state, you know, that, you know, describing, I think there's a phrase where he sort of describes himself or people in his situation as the shit of empire.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
that's right.
They really are the sort of detritus. So,
That was my idea that, you know, he had all these hopes and dreams and he was a qualified engineer or whatever, and he came here and he got a crap job and literally, you know.
The idea that he sort of came home smelling of it as well.
It's that was the idea. I wanted to make it as extreme
as... It's so much under the skin.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know any Asian people who've worked in the sewers. Maybe there are none, you know, but that wasn't... My point. I know people that have worked in equally degrading jobs, and you know, or have been wasted by the experience of emigration and by the drudgery of the job.
Yeah, or they can't get something comparable with their previous job.
And you see them walking about the streets, people that are obviously in their 50s, but look like they're in their 80s, and they're hobbling about on sticks, and you think, you know,
what's it done to?
What's happened? Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's the long hours, all that stuff. So it's a kind of, each of them is like a Zola epic, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and it's isn't it? You know, and Zola wrote about the peasants coming to the city and all that stuff and floors and all that stuff. Well, it's happening and it still happens and so on and so forth. And so, you know, I wanted to encapsulate that. And I also wanted a man who was not a patriarchal macho monster.
Right.
Because Das father isn't that.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so, I think that while those people exist and it's a real problem, patriarchy is a real problem in South Asian society and in diasporic society as well. And I spend sort of... at least a quarter of my life fighting it, and so I know all about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I see a lot of portrayals of older Asian men, middle-aged older Asian men, particularly first-generation Asian men who talk in a South Asian accent as patriarchal monsters, you know, and they're not all patriarchal monsters, you know.
It's too much of a stereotype. If that's
it is. And so I wanted to portray a man who was broken, you know, by his own talent and fragility, and he was broken, you know, and now he'd lost his, he was losing his mind, you know.
Yes, the whole thing is sort of crumbling.
Yeah, although at the same time, in his loss of mind, he's seeing times compress into parallel, which they are, in a sense, and you know, his son that he's kind of abandoned some time ago in Pakistan is now haunting him in the figure of Zaf.
Right,
and he keeps wanting, you know. And so that's another ghost in the story that's there, you know. And and his son's name is Kesar, which means Kaiser, Caesar, Emperor, King.
Yeah.
It comes from the Roman Caesar. It's a common name in India and Pakistan.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Kesar is the female, which is Queens of Governors, Kesara.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. So, Emperor. So, in his mind, that,
that still got
perfect
that
son. Yeah,
right.
Perfect
yeah.
son. Mm-hmm. So, that was another, you know, I wanted to kind of break a few, you know, stereotypes and things, and things that hadn't perhaps been done before in that way.
I think with the father as well, in a way, by sort of dealing with the whole kind of empirical fallout, if you like, with him, you kind of separated that off as well. It stopped it from sort of, you know, in some ways that, you know, stories about people who have emigrated and so on, it can be too dominant, if
you
like.
Yes,
but by sort of making that such a focal point with his job and so on,
totally,
I felt that you sort of put that in its place without having it take over the whole.
Yeah, it could have taken over the whole. What I didn't want to do was write an epic about immigration, because I thought, well, that's been done ad nauseam, and there's always a place for it, you know. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, if somebody, you know, should write about what they want to write about, but you know, I didn't want to do that again, you know, and I wanted to add something different to it and explore it slightly surreally and differently, you know, and not have this realistic epic that, you know, 1,000 pages long that, you know, explored 3 generations of, you know, Asian women or something, and blah, blah, blah. You know, I wanted to have this different thing going on, you know, and move it on a little bit. And get drilled into its, into, you know, deeper than just surface things, you know. And, and what's a journey? It's an epic thing. And I wanted to get into that. That's why I made them go by land.
Right,
You know, that's why I made them drive by car all the way from Lahore to Britain, and which in fact you could do in those days, and a lot of people did the reverse, of course. The hippie trail was the reverse of that, you know, it went you know, and so people did drive, and a few people did actually drive from Pakistan to Britain, actually, a very few people.
I've actually heard of somebody making that journey by land not so terribly long ago. It was quite a dangerous journey.
Point, I mean, you could do it, I mean, now, in fact, but you know, but so I wanted to do that because, again, there's an epicness, there's a sort of permanence about it, isn't there? This idea of land, migration of tribes sort of goes back to the past, doesn't it? All the tribes migrated west and so on and so forth. And, you know, you change as you travel and blah, blah, and your protective thing around you is much more fragile.
I think movement, you know, within living memory as well, or within a few generations, you know, like you get in North America, people are nearly always sort of hyphenated in some way, whether they see themselves as Scottish Americans or Irish Americans or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a lot of people, I suppose, people like myself that have sort of grown up, you know, with generations all being Scottish as far back as they could remember.
Yeah.
I suppose if you went far back enough, they end up being Norwegian or Irish or something.
A combination of things, probably.
But when it's within living memory, it does something different. You know,
I think so. Because
power over people.
It's a spell. I mean, it's a source of, it's an oral history. It's a source of, I mean, it is. You listen to tales, parents or grandparents or older people, you know, and you read stuff and you read accounts of other people's experiences and so on. And all of that is literally, it's oral history. Of course, that's what oral history is.
Yeah.
So in a way, you're sort of writing down oral history, which is the process, isn't it, that people have gone through, peoples have gone through, you know. And it's like the myths of travel and so on. And then once those myths start becoming infiltrated by sort of real myths, if you like, I mean, real legends from, you know, then it changes again, you know. And there are a lot of references in there to the ancient Greeks and other peoples, you know, that kind of crossed the path of this journey. You know, 'cause Alexander, of course, and his journey was, you know... And all of that, and it's also a way of evincing the fundamental links between different cultures that are actually define those cultures. They aren't peripheral; they're central.
Right.
You know, and in a way, a de facto way, it debunks this kind of clash of civilizations idea. This idea of discrete civilizations that are always at war with one another, which is a political construct, which is flawed, I think, you know, deeply flawed, in fact. And you do just have to scratch the surface to find that out. You know, and so in a way, that was another exploration that I wanted to evince in this novel, this link between, and of course the landscape and the liminality of Scotland itself, this kind of lochs and mountains and, you know, up north, and there's a lot of that. There's a Celtic rock band in there, and who's central to the piece as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to get that as well, without kind of being twee or you know, kind of Ossian-ish about it. You know, I wanted to get, there is something very deep in that. You know, and which has been forgotten by a lot of people that live in metropolises, metropoli, whatever they're called. Metropolitan. No, that's patriarch, isn't it? The Orthodox patriarch. Anyway. I'm drifting. It's been forgotten by a lot of people who live in big cities and so on.
Yes,
you know, they don't.
Yeah,
uh-huh. And I think it's very close here in Scotland still.
Mm,
I do think that. You realise that when you go to the Midlands or of England or something. Mm. You realise actually how close it still is.
Mm,
you know?
Right.
You just have to talk to people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they tell stories. They tell stories about, you know, their grandmother who lived in a black house or something,
yes,
or a croft,
yes,
or, you know, uh-huh. some weird place in, you know, Lothian that was kind of... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I suppose the clearances as well is one of these sort
of
evocative things that, even if your family wasn't directly tied up in anything like that, there's still this sort of...
Oh, it echoes down history, doesn't it?
It still has an effect.
Oh, yeah, it echoes down history. Mm-hmm. And the kind of lack of confidence that I think, to some extent, does still pervade within Scotland, although it's better now than it was.
Yeah,
no doubt about that. But there is still that certain lack of confidence, you know, that I can detect, and people that come from outside can detect more readily.
Oh, yes. I mean, even when I was in school, there was very much a sense that you spoke when you had something relevant to say.
Yeah.
And if you had something stupid to say, you would be told in no uncertain terms how stupid
absolutely,
it was.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, well, exactly.
It's quite hard.
You know,
if
you listen to people in England talking of a similar social class, they'll talk, they're much more garrulous, they'll talk a lot more in general, you know.
Right,
often about nothing in particular, actually, but you know, there is that, and I think it's this kind of anti-syzygy thing, you know, you can make too much of this, but I think it does exist.
Yes,
I think it does exist. And I think, you know, this idea of Scotland sort of as the kind of colony, again, it can be overplayed, and it's much more complex than that. I mean, it's not the situation that Ireland was in, by no means, but at the same time, there were elements of it.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, the clearances.
Again, that's something else, actually, about Sycorag that I meant to ask you, because there's a lot of emphasis on the family coming to England, even though they're in Scotland, and sometimes it's put in sort of, you know, those terms.
Deliberately.
I wondered if, you know, is there a sense that England is kind of the seat of the empire, and Scotland's sort of, you know, almost like part of England?
I deliberately did that because for people of an older generation, Asian people or from outside, when they talk about Britain, they talk about England. Angres Lough means English people, means British people.
Right.
But it wasn't a word for Scottish. Even though most of the administrators and the residents, you know, with the capital R, you know, the colonial administrator, colonial agents, were in fact Scottish.
Right,
In the British Empire.
I think that's true of quite
a lot
of other languages, actually. So somebody I met recently from Luxembourg
was
saying the same thing, that the word they used for the whole island actually meant England.
Well, of course it did, you know, because, I mean, it was the dominant, it was populace-wise and population-wise and politically and all that. And so, you know, England was the place, and it still is, if you talk to people out there in you know, South Asia, it's England, you know, it's England, this England, that.
All these English authors like James Joyce and George Bernard Shaw.
Precisely, you know, precisely. So that's the thing. So for people, and that's internalised in their minds, so when they come here, even if they're living in Scotland, they'll talk about Angres Lough, you know, and it'll be England. It might be changing now, but deep down, England is the dominant, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
So when they talk, particularly when they're looking back, they talk about coming to England, you know, quite a lot of the time. So that's the thing. So that was I wanted to get that difference between the generations. Zaf, it's very obviously Scottish, you know, and whereas his parents came to England, and may have moved up from England or whatever they did, you know.
But that was the important aspect.
That's
way. That was the thing.
They didn't know about Scotland.
Right.
The idea is that they moved to the periphery because they wanted to get as far away from other nations as possible because of this history of theirs of adultery and all that stuff.
Yes.
But you know, they came to England. That was the point, you know. And so, and it's ironic, isn't it? Because as I said earlier, a lot of the administrators in the empire were actually Scottish.
Right. Yes.
But in a sense, must have sublimated their own Scottishness, whatever that was, because they were educated in anglicised public schools.
Yeah, I think a lot of that as well.
And kind of went there, and you know,
there's kind of elements that still go on to an extent that a lot of Scottish people, you know, they can speak standard English if they choose to do so.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And yet they can speak a lot of Scots.
Yeah.
And most people kind of use both.
Of course. Yeah.
But there is a sort of it's as if you can kind of, if you want to be if you want to assimilate and sort of disappear linguistically, then you go towards standard English.
Of course.
And then people looking at records later on or whatever, you know, that they would have to know where you were from.
Correct.
Or you'd have to have a Mac surname or something to give you away.
Yeah.
Because you can just sort of disappear and blend in.
Totally, totally. Well, I think that's what happened in the 19th century.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was a deliberate... I mean, clearly it was a deliberate policy. Public schools were set up and, you know... the ones in Scotland as well as the ones in England, and they would it was like factories would churn out administrators for the empire, and they would go in whatever they went in as, you know, Scottish or whatever they were, you know, and they would come out sort of, do you know what I mean?
Being English processed. Blooming.
Well, essentially, you know, and maybe that's a generalisation. I mean, I'm sure it is, but whatever, you know, to the subject peoples, they would appear English.
Yes,
do you know what I mean?
Yes. It was so, the voice of authority.
Of course, it was. You know, and that was the thing. Mm. And the last thing they would have wanted to do was show up any divisions within the dominant group, you know, because they were in the minority there, and you know, it was, do you know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know, and so I think that's an interesting thing, because South Asians were used as middlemen as well in East Africa, you know, and South Africa, and that's the way empires work, and they always have. I mean, the Roman Empire sent Syrian legionaries to the Hadrian's Wall and the Antonine Wall, and British legionaries to Palestine. It's the way it's always worked, you know.
Right.
So, that's all very interesting to me, you know, and that kind of that layered quality to Scottishness, whatever it is, and its fluidity, you know, and you know, this idea of this tweeness that developed, you know, deliberately,
sort of Celia,
all that stuff, and Walter Scott, and all that stuff, and the kind of appropriation of Burns and blah blah, and you know, and you know, you know, I always think they have a thing in Glasgow called the Burns Iqbal Supper. Iqbal being the premier poet of Pakistan in the 20th century, and Burns, of course, of Scotland.
Right.
So the Burns Iqbal Supper, which is great, you know, it's a wonderful thing to have, and I'm all for it, and I go to it and everything.
Uh-huh.
But it's interesting, because I sometimes want to stand up and say, look, both these guys were alcoholics, both these guys were womanizers, and you know, and that they have that in common too. You know, they weren't these pristine national symbols that you made them into.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They were raving, you know, sort of loud, you know, whatever they were, as well as all those things. And so let's humanize it a little bit. Let's scratch under the skin and get what drives flesh and blood here, you know. And yes, it's myth, and it's myth in many different directions. And that way you can stop it from being fossilized, I think.
Right. Yes.
And the more fluid it is, the more dynamic it is, and the less essentialist, you know. And that's what I was, to some extent, trying to do in Psycho-Rag, particularly with Zaf, of course, you know. I mean, he's all fluid, isn't he? He's all kind of, you know, he's everywhere, isn't he? That's the thing.
And his use of language as well is so interesting to me.
Yeah,
that, you know, that there are times where he'll intersperse bits of Urdu and other languages in what he's saying. You know,
that's right.
He does the greetings in sort of several different languages, one after the other.
Well, that's right.
And also the fact that he, you know, that... bits of the narrative are pretty much standard English, but other bits are much more Scottish and have a lot more Scots
in them. It kind of flows, and it's unstable.
It comes in and out.
It's unstable.
Yeah.
But it's deliberately unstable. I mean, it's not that I was shoddy about it or anything. I mean, and if you talk about the poet that, I can't remember if it was Keats, or, you know, he added a comma in the morning and he took out a comma in the afternoon, that's all he did. But I kind of understand that, you know, because I changed words so many times in Psycho-Rag. I mean, I don't know how many words are in it, but lots anyway, 140,000 or something. Anyway, and eventually I kind of had this idea that I wouldn't have fixed boundaries, and I would just let things flow. And so you would have very Scottish bits where he's broadcasting, almost deliberately artificial, you know, broad Glaswegian, or where he's very sort of emotional, you know.
Yes, there's a bit where he's, I think, is it where he's talking about Zilla?
Yeah, that's
right. Where he gets very, very worked up,
that's
and he gets extremely Scottish.
Exactly, because that's, again, her ambience, isn't it? Her, she also talks about
and she is Glasgow as well.
She is, she's completely... And yet when we have the romanticised vision of 1959 Lahore and the parents' love affair, that's completely standard English.
Right,
and it's very, very sort of compartmentalised, pretty almost.
Yes.
You know, because that's their vision of it.
Yes.
You know, as people do have a romantic vision of their romance. I mean, that's of it, hopefully, from the past.
Yeah.
You know?
And yet with the empire tied into that.
Exactly. And all of that, the social class division, the whole thing. And so, and then when Zaf is thinking, talking, you know, internal monologues, it's a kind of what you might call educated middle class Scottish person. So it's basically standard English, but with some of the G's cut off at the end.
Yes.
So, you know, so it's like that. So he has these three voices, the very standard English voice. And the other thing is, he becomes subsumed into the subject matter of the place and time that he's talking about or thinking about.
Yes.
That was another thing, because when he's thinking about Glasgow in the 19th century, early 20th century, where underneath the Botanic Gardens, where the Light Empress is riding the rails, it's a different voice again.
Yeah,
and he
he's quite sort of porous in that.
It is. He's completely porous. Yeah. He has no fixed persona. Mm, mm. Everything is flowing through him.
Yeah.
And my idea was that the place you're in, the time you're in, the context you're in, and even the history about which you're thinking mm. will influence your physical, the sound of your mm, voice, mm, the song you're mm-hmm. evincing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my whole point about this.
Mm, mm.
And then what you speak is what you are. The way mm. you talk influences your mind and how you see yourself at
yes,
that moment.
Yeah.
Of course it does,
mm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It influences your facial structure because your muscles act mm. differently,
mm-hmm.
you know? Because if I talk very, very posh English, mm. I have to move my mouth in a certain way with no lips.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And if I did that all day...
It's a physical change.
It's
yeah.
a physical change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a psychic change.
Mm.
So this is the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want, you know... It was kind of taking Kelman and injecting some LSD or something, you know,
mm.
I don't know how to put it, but it was
yeah.
a bit like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to take that very powerful possibility,
mm. yeah.
a political
mm-hmm.
thing that he does...
Mm-hmm.
And take it, I don't know if you call it a stage further, but just make it different, you know,
mm-hmm.
transform it in some way,
yeah.
again, you know,
mm-hmm.
and utilise standard English,
mm.
but make it into a kind of, to massage it and use it as a music,
right.
which it is,
yes.
you know,
yeah.
and not regard it as a kind of decorum thing,
mm-hmm.
but actually mm-hmm. use it and, you know, put it on the same level and use it
mm-hmm.
in different
mm-hmm.
ways. So we have the standard Imperial English, we have everything in there.
Mm.
Dancing together.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which, to me, is the ultimate sort of leveller,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, I didn't think about all this before I wrote the novel.
Right.
Now
yeah.
I'm going to write a novel that's very... that's going to level everything, including myself.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that, you know?
Yes.
I basically just kind of... that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
and I did want to use the Glaswegian idiom.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to use some standard English,
yeah.
because I'd explored
mm-hmm.
that in some of the earlier stories that I'd written.
Mm.
But I didn't know how it would pan out.
Mm-hmm. But I think it
you know?
Fits very well for places like Glasgow as well, where, I mean, you know, smallest differences like, you know, when do you say yes and when do you say I when you're talking to somebody?
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
that people are constantly switching from one sort of style to another.
Completely, yeah.
I think it really sort of reflects that.
Mm, totally. You don't, you know, people are not fixed
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
in their orbits,
yeah.
thankfully, in a way.
Yes.
I mean, and of course, it's driven, though, by class
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and class expectations. And
yes.
people,
yeah.
when they talk to you, if they immediately in Britain,
mm.
we ascertain someone's class by the way they talk.
Oh, very much
right?
so, yes.
Subconsciously,
yeah.
we do it.
Mm.
And then we pitch our own voice towards that level, depending on what the dominant,
mm-hmm.
you know, it goes up the way, you know.
Right,
do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So, if someone is meeting someone from an upper class, they'll elevate their
mm,
right,
mm, yeah.
and rather than the other person coming down, if that's
mm.
the right way of putting it, you know, in terms of the social class
yeah,
hierarchy,
yeah,
right?
The way that people
generally
adjust.
Speaking,
yeah. mm-hmm.
Unless somebody's kind of in a situation like a football match where they think it's
mm, mm-hmm.
you know appropriate
yes.
to do that,
yeah, mm-hmm.
so there are all these little negotiations that go on
mm,
and,
mm.
unspoken,
yes.
you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting because it gives you insights into character and into history
mm, mm-hmm.
and the history of class in this
mm-hmm.
country, which is very crucially important, I think, you know,
mm.
clearly, and remains so.
Mm.
And also, of course, you know, history in terms of you know population movements within Scotland
mm.
and within
mm-hmm.
the British Isles,
yeah.
and as well as from outside,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so on, and historical things. So, yeah, I think it's great fun. I find it great
mm.
fun, but it's very difficult. I mean. It's not easy,
mm-hmm.
you know, to do all this and to make it effective and to
right.
make it, you know,
mm.
and it's never, I know it's now a cliche, the text really is never fixed,
mm.
you know, because
mm-hmm.
if I had to rewrite Psychorag, God forbid, you know, if I would probably write it differently.
Yeah, yeah.
And the voices would change again
mm,
in some way,
mm.
you know. And then there are as many possible versions of Psychorag as there are readers, actually,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
And then some.
Mm,
there are versions
mm.
that will never be written, but exist in potentiality.
Mm,
you know, it's a very
mm.
sort of Borgesian idea that, you know,
right.
isn't it? Or Derrida or something, you know, that
mm.
there are all these. And it really is, it isn't a cop-out, you know, to say that.
Mm,
I think it
yeah.
actually is quite a fluid
mm-hmm.
thing, you
yeah.
know. And there are stories
well,
that I've written.
There have to be different ways of reading it, really.
There are.
So, yeah.
More than just the average... story.
Mm.
You know, I've written
mm.
stories
mm-hmm.
saying standard English, whether okay, all these things apply, but the language is fairly fixed, you know.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
but in that book, it's not,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I always see things that I could change again, you know, and
mm.
and then
yeah.
I would change them back, and I would agonize over them, and you know,
yeah.
and then the editor would agonize over them, and, you know, and now I'm writing a book which is actually although it's in standard English.
Mm.
In other words, it's not exploring this kind of vigorous, you know,
mm-hmm.
demotic thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm pouring in different words from different languages as
oh,
appropriate.
Right, right,
yeah,
right.
Not so much in the kind of thought speech of the person, but
mm.
as appropriate,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the place they're in or the situation they're in or
right.
in historical terms.
Yeah.
And I'll start to kind of break down. I like following etymologies to their source of origin.
Right,
so I'll look up the dictionary and I'll look up the web, or I'll do something with, you know, and I'll look up an etymology of a simple word like, you know, beryl.
Mm.
The name beryl is a Persian word for the stone, of course, beryl,
right,
semi-precious stone.
Yeah.
But it's actually a Persian word.
Mm,
so not many beryls know that, I can vouch. They'll know it's obviously a semi-precious stone,
yes,
but they won't know anything beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And you kind of break it down and you follow it back in time and place and you see where it came from and how it's evolved and all the different meanings that it possibly has.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives a frisson, a charge to that word that didn't have before, and my knowledge of that and my use of it in the text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if I'm in a place, I'll try and project to another place by using it in a certain strategic way or tactical way that will take you to that other place by importing a legend or importing something else.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I'm doing that, and I enjoy doing that because it's like playing across space and time and thought and stories with no, potentially no boundaries, you know, except the story that's driving you on.
Yeah.
Of course, it leads to sort of large baggy monsters of books, potentially, which is, that's the way I do it, you know.
Yeah.
But it's fun, and I think it breaks down barriers that sometimes aren't broken down too much in literature, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody has commented about one of the things I was writing that, oh, there are too many foreign words in it. That's the whole point. You know, you know, they've missed the whole point, you know. It's like, you know, and they should have read Psychorog then. Then they would have realised what a book with lots of foreign words is really like.
Yes.
You know. So, as we all know, all languages are fluid and have been formed through fluidity and through hybridity and they're evolving as we, you know. I read somewhere that the Queen's English is not as posh as it was 50 years ago.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah,
yeah. It's
true, isn't it?
Quite a lot.
Right?
Yeah, listen to the 1950s broadcast.
Well, exactly.
It's all very plummy.
Exactly, right. So that's one person living in a very closeted environment.
Yes.
You know, you know, and her accent has changed.
Yeah, yeah.
So anything is possible, actually,
yes,
you know, in reality,
mm-hmm.
and therefore in fiction it's even more so. So, yeah. I've come to the end of that stream.
Right. Did you want to say something else about the book you're writing just now, and what you're working on?
Well, I don't want to talk about it, actually, because it's still happening. And
right.
superstition, and also just the energy's there, you know, in my notebooks and in my head. And until I really, you know, once I've written it and it's kind of out there, then I'll talk ad infinitum. But it's just I don't...
I'll maybe come back to you then.
Yes, absolutely. You'd even longer take. But some of the areas that I'm exploring are perhaps I could talk about, and that is history, of course, as usual. I love history. That's one of the subjects I loved at school, and I've loved it ever since. And history is the wellspring, I think, you know, the stories of people and knowledge and all that. And I'm exploring ideas of patriarchy and war and the link between the two.
All right.
And from a female point of view again, I seem to be writing a lot of that just now. To do with South Asia, particularly, and how, the knock-on effect of one war leading to another war, leading to another war, leading to another war, and an endless spiral, you know, just goes on and on and on. And how do you break that, you know, how do you finish it, you know, and within people's heads as well as, you know, I mean, we all know about the arms thing, and I know all about that, but also in people's heads, you know, because ordinary people, you know, kill one another. If nobody did that, then it wouldn't happen. I mean, it's simplistic, but true. I mean, these massacres and things occur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ordinary soldiers, you know, our boys or their boys or somebody's boys, go out there and do these things, and intercommunal violence and all that stuff.
Yeah. And it does involve everybody participating.
It's of course, it does.
There was a program about the Holocaust not long ago,
and
if you remember, the trailer was sort of saying, you know, I drove the trucks, I
through
the gates, and you know, ordinary people who were all contributing.
Exactly,
to that,
exactly. So. Mm. And you know, somebody makes a decision at some point. And not everybody's having a gun pointed at their head, making them do it.
Yeah.
You know, and some people don't do it, and therefore
you
have to ask, why did those people not do it? And those people, you know, what was, you know, and how do they then live with it? And what are the consequences for the victims, for generations, and so on, and all that, and how, you know, and so I'm looking at that very sort of light topic.
Well, it's very topical.
You know, and all that, a very dark topic, And also looking at, on the other hand, in a different way, in different things, different kinds of work that I'm doing at, you know, folk tales, legends, you know, mythology. It's always fascinated me that, you know, and the commonalities, because folk tales have travelled all over the place, you know, and people also tell similar stories, you know, and landscape and history in the present, you know, its relevance in the present, you know, and how it might inspicite into the present in ways that we don't realise.
Right.
And that kind of thing, which kind of follows on from kind of what I'm writing, but it backgrounds the kind of, you know, race and kind of immigrant stuff that's backgrounded now, you know. Right. I want to kind of explore other areas, and as I've done in The Burning Mirror, the short story collection, and The White Cliffs, and I wrote about medieval France and 60s Eastbourne in England, and I've written about other things as well, posted on the web, novellas and things, you know.
Right.
And so my interests are kind of legion, and I kind of follow my nose, really, you know. And so I'm doing that at the moment, and writing several different things,
right.
A novel, a stage play, and some miscellaneous things, exploring these areas, you know. And I don't know what I'll do after that, but I'll let that come when it comes. Again, I'm always trying to do something different, from what I've done before.
Mm-hmm.
Write about what I don't know, to turn the cliche on its head.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And something different from what I think other people might have done, although I don't have access to the whole panoply, the whole canon of literature in every different language. But something different, perhaps, from what has been done before. You know, I don't see the point of reinventing the wheel or repeating what other people have done. I think I have quite an original voice.
Yes, I would say so.
Right, and quite a strong. So I want to use that and take it in different directions. Mm. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And directions that don't pander to anyone's kind of preconceived ideas, even my own, especially my own, you know.
Right.
Just try to kind of puncture the balloon.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's very refreshing, I find, to read things that sort of get away from stereotypes and do surprise you and bring something fresh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of the things I enjoy very much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's rude, isn't it? I mean, Sayadaw is a very rude book. I mean, not just in terms of expletives and neologistic expletives, but also in terms of the fact that it really does. You know, it talks about horrible things, and it kind of talks about discomforting things, and it doesn't resolve them. It doesn't resolve people's prejudices. It just kind of takes them as far as it. Do you know what I mean?
And sometimes laying them bare as well is quite refreshing.
I think so.
I remember one of the things that you know, I sort of, it kind of took me aback when I was thinking of my own childhood when I read it. There was a reference to things like television programs, or maybe it was you mentioned it to me on a previous occasion, that things like Eight and a Half Hot Mum.
Oh yes, yes.
On the TV.
Yes.
And I sort of think, oh yes, I remember that from my childhood. Watching
We used to watch that.
Watching it while I was having my dinner.
Yes, we used to do that as well.
And I just thought, what can that be like from an immigrant's perspective?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, suddenly you sort of think there are things in your own culture that you've taken for granted.
Of course, yes.
And you think, oh my God, really?
Well, it's just like being a man and taking things for granted. And, you know, until you become aware enough, or until somebody else points it out to you, you didn't realise that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the same, in a way, it's the same, you know? And I didn't. I mean, at the time, I internalised it. Oh, I was watching. I enjoyed it too.
Right.
Yeah, and we used to watch it every Sunday evening, whatever. You know, watched it, enjoyed it, and laughed at it, and everything.
Yeah.
And then it was only kind of later that sort of realised, God, you know, it was like, you know. And obviously, I internalised all that stuff. You know.
Right. Yeah,
all of that stuff, negative as it was, of course, you know, and it could have been different. You know, but in a way, I wouldn't be the writer that I am had it not been for all that stuff. It's a funny way of looking at it, really, but pardon me, it's not a justification for it, but it all fed into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a way, it's kind of getting back, in a sense, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, in a sense, you know, I'm getting back at those images and the actors who never got the roles, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
you know, and all that stuff.
I suppose it's revisiting things with a more informed view as well, which I think everybody does to some extent, that you look back on things that you thought were totally sort of mild and, you know, inoffensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see it with a different perspective suddenly it's
you
not
do.
The same thing.
And as a writer also, through your characters, by definition almost, you, if you're writing from the soul, if you're writing from the depths and not holding anything back, then you are exposing your own deficiencies.
Right, yeah.
You know, who the characters have your deficiencies, but also they have deficiencies that you have heard other people say about you or think about you, because that's a good way of, you know, because if you can kind of deal, you know, expose your own deficiencies, then you can make them run, you know.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Kind of exercising,
of course,
in a way.
And it's looking at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of psychotherapy in a way. You know, very sick psychotherapy, but it's in a way, you know, you're looking at yourself in a mirror.
Yeah,
you know, you're holding yourself up to the world and exposing yourself in a way.
Yes. Maybe that comes back to what you were saying about, you know, people writing in a more natural, instinctive sort of a way, that you know, if you can sort of just be vulnerable to that, if you like, just run with it, then you produce something more genuine.
Yeah. And then even if you are writing in a kind of artificial, and all writing is artifice, all fiction is artifice, it's all lies, you know, that's what it means, you know. But even if you're writing, and I've written some stylized stories as well, you see that, you know, sort of, and yet if there's that kind of internal power coming through, even in the most stylized of stories, it will come through in the same way that power comes through in Homer.
Right, yes.
Right, or the Book of Kings, the Shahnameh in Persian. Yeah. There's a power about it, isn't there? Yes, a visceral power which comes through.
It's the mythology, I suppose. But it's I've always liked both C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. I've always liked their writing. And they had this sort of whole debate. You probably know about this yourself, but they had this whole debate
about
myths were.
Yeah.
And C.S. Lewis had said that myths were lies, even if lies breathed through silver.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tolkien had a totally different view. He was saying that, you know, every word that we use, you know, every time we label something, we're kind of creating something. We're sort of sub-creators ourselves, you know, if you call a tree, and so on. And I was always sort of drawn to that kind of dichotomy, you know, is metaphor just another expression of something real?
Yeah.
You know, whereas other people sort of take the view that it's all kind of made up and so, you know, it's trivial. But I like the whole sort of thing that it's real.
Yeah.
You know, the metaphor can be real.
Oh yeah. I mean, so. I think both their views are correct. Actually, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Actually.
But it's an interesting debate.
It is an interesting debate. I certainly don't think it's trivial. You know, because that's what I do. So, but also, I mean, I don't think it's trivial because, you know, otherwise nobody would ever bother telling any stories or writing any stories. And since they've been in caves before writing was even invented, people would be making.
Well, trivial is probably the wrong word, but somehow if you call it a lie, you are sort of demoting it to an extent.
Yeah, to an extent, yeah.
You're sort of separating them out.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, maybe I'm not.
But you're trying to get to a deeper truth, aren't you? Yes. And that's the point, you know. You know, and I forgot to say at the beginning, C.S. Lewis was another, again, another enlightened teacher. Gave us The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe in primary school to read, and I enjoyed that, and I read the entire series then, and then I read Tolkien, the entire everything, and you know, it was a wee boy thing, you know, as well, you know, Tolkien, you know, obviously, and in a way, you know, and so that was a kind of from Alice in Wonderland, it kind of, you know, took off. And all of that stuff, I think that's where I developed a love for fantasy. I don't mean fantasy in the Dungeons and Dragons sense, in the genre sense.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with that genre, but I don't mean it that way. I mean it in the kind of Alberto Manguel sense, fantastical literature, which is basically surreal literature, where you look into the black mirror and you see something on the other side. You know, it's very much again that Scottish. You know, what's that guy? That, James. We're all called James. what's that writer? Way ahead of his time. He wrote about this doppelganger. What's it called? God, I've forgotten. You know what I mean? This murderous doppelganger that was a bit like Jekyll and Hyde, but he wrote it before Jekyll and Hyde.
I'm not sure.
I think he pushes the guy off the cliff.
Right.
Confessions of a Justified Sinner.
Yes, James Hogg.
Right, James Hogg.
Yes, I do remember
that. That's an interesting novel, isn't it?
Yes.
Because that is a fantastical novel.
Yes, yeah.
In that sense.
And again, there's that sense of sort of unreality.
Completely.
And when is this really happening?
Completely.
And when is it his imagination and all that?
Yeah,
kind of question of identity.
Absolutely. Now, I hadn't read that novel before I wrote Psycho Rug.
Right, yeah.
I've read it since, you know. And in fact, a lot of stuff I hadn't read, and then somebody said, oh, it's like some of the stuff he writes like Calvino. So then I went and read Calvino. Some of the stuff he writes like this. So then I went, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So a lot of the stuff, actually, I wasn't drawing on. In retrospect, I've drawn on those writers, and since then.
Yes.
But in fact, I hadn't read Alistair Gray till 1995. And I hadn't read Lanark till then, and I read it because somebody said, oh, and so I read it. So a lot of my stuff comes, I think, from reading epics like the Shahnameh, the Persian epic, and you know, folk tales, and you know, I'm kind of going back to the same sources that these guys probably went back to, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
well, again, the sort of Tolkien idea of going back to kind of Germanic mythology and all these things.
That's right.
You know, and I remember reading Beowulf and finding little bits about, you know, the item being stolen from the dragon's hoard, and thinking, oh yes, you know, I'd met that first in Tolkien. And
that's
so,
right.
In a way, I don't think it matters sort of where you come in, at which point in time, as long as you get there.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
It sort of sucks you into the whole history.
I agree completely. Yeah. You know, I mean, I can't remember whether I started to get into urban realist Scottish fiction after I read Kelman, or before I read Kelman, actually.
Yeah.
But I think I read him in order to kind of develop the voice a bit, you know, and just to enjoy the writing. But I think I was exposed to a lot of writers early on in my writing career in the late 80s and early 90s who wrote in that mode because they'd been influenced by people like Kelman and Leonard and all that. So that was all, it was a thing. And people would get up in this poetry, you know, and some would be better than others, obviously. But so I was exposed to all of this stuff at that point without fully knowing where it had come from at that point, you know, because I was literate, but I wasn't fully literate in that sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
as someone who had done an English or a Scottish degree, whatever you want to call it, you know, right. would have done.
Yes. Yeah.
And in a way, that was my deficiency at that time. But I'd read things that they would never have read, of course. Mm-hmm. I'd read things. Mm-hmm. But also, that was also good for me because yes. I came into it kind of with my from my gut, you know.
Yes, yeah. It's a more natural
yes.
reaction
yeah.
to it. Yeah.
And I kind of tried to kind of try to transmute reality from a position without being influenced by all these different writers at an early stage,
yes. yeah.
which I think is quite good, actually, in retrospect,
yeah.
you know. Mm-hmm. And then I've kind of incorporated some of their stuff in my mind, you know, and obviously, you know, does that make sense? I don't know if that makes sense.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a sense, I suppose, when you're sort of you're learning something, you know, on a course as such that, you know, you're maybe sort of driven in the direction of particular critics or particular schools of criticism.
At an early age.
There are times where I've found that quite sort of difficult. You know, it's sort of, it's maybe been useful to have that as one of the choices before you, if you like.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily been what I really want to do with that text.
No,
and so in a way, you know, maybe, yes, those things are good to dabble in for a while, but not to be totally overwhelmed by.
I think so. I think you're right. And I think also, to be honest, I wasn't overly intimidated by the Western canon. That was another crucial point.
Right.
Even though I'm effectively monolingual, my knowledge of Urdu is basic. And obviously my knowledge of Scots is fragmentary and transient and depends. I mean, Scots as in deep Scots, you know, as opposed to Glaswegian accents and things.
Yeah.
But and French likewise. But you know, I'd read other things from other parts of the world in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost at the same time as I read Dickens and all that, you know.
Yes.
And so I wasn't intimidated. You know, I didn't think, oh, this is the gold standard or this is the, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that would have happened, you know, but I think there is that tendency perhaps, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I tended to incorporate that kind of thing from an early stage, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also because it was my kind of me.
Yeah.
It was my life.
Yeah.
It was, you know...
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't see it as, you know, I never saw these things as compartmentalized, separate, and one as being better than the other. And, you know, I never actually, honestly never saw that. And so I think my sort of lack of literary training, if you like, whatever you want to call it, in that sense has served me in good stead. And I've read widely, obviously, since then, but perhaps differently from perhaps some other people would have read, you know, who'd come along that path, you know. And, and I'm always interested to talk to people, you know, and share sort of things that we've read and then get recommendations from them and give them recommendations. And I remember being on a BBC thing called, I can't remember what it was called, but it was like the top 20 books or something. And I think listeners had to, it was a radio thing, listeners had to vote for the top 20 books of all time. It's one of these slightly silly things, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I stepped in at the last minute because one of my pals who was there wasn't well. And so I didn't really know what it was about. So there I was sitting there in the Mitchell Library being taped and... God knows what, by the BBC, with this audience. We had to talk about books that had influenced us and books we liked.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I literally just pulled books off the shelf at home and put them in a big knapsack.
Right.
You know, it was like Christmas time and I was like Santa, you know, with this big knapsack, you know. And some of the books that I'd got out of libraries over the years, I'd written them on my hand, you know, so that I didn't have them anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, there were two other writers, they're very good writers, and they had obviously prepared stuff for it. And they read these wonderful things, one about Treasure Island and another one about something else. And it was fantastic. And I thought, how am I going to follow this? You know, it's like, you know. And so I just started talking about the books that I enjoyed and pulling out the books out of the hat, like rabbits out of a hat, you know, and talking about them.
Yeah.
And because the people hadn't heard of a lot of the books before, I didn't engineer it that way. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, they were really interested in what's that. They were coming up to me afterwards saying, what's that book? Let me get the title.
Mm.
And it was books, some of them I've mentioned just now, books from different parts of the world, different times.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody, a professor actually put his hand up and said, what do you think about the top 20? It was called something else, I can't remember, but it was like the top 20. And I said, what is that? And he said, it's behind you. It was the list on big billboards behind me of the top 20 books.
Yes.
And looking at the top 20 books that had been allegedly voted for by the listeners,
they
were all Anglophone books, They were all from the British Isles or America, North America, but mainly from the British Isles.
Mm-hmm.
They were mainly current popular books, you know, populist books, or 19th century novels.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that was from another was War and Peace, Tolstoy.
Yes.
I think that was it.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest were... And I thought... You know, I thought,
Yeah, you know, almost as if they're sort of voting for them because they're iconic rather than...
Yeah, or because they're enjoying that book at the moment and it's being plugged in.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they're enjoying them in many cases, but, but they've also got that like, kind of canonical status.
But it wasn't like they were thinking, what is... And first of all, it's a silly thing to draw up anyway, actually, but if you're going to drop key books that have influenced you or that you love as a reader, instead of thinking about that, you know, whatever. So there was that, and I sort of went through them and I said, well, you know, okay, you know, this is that. But... you know, it's fine, you know, but I wouldn't call it that. If you're going to say what are the best or most significant, because of the question, I don't think it was the best. I think the question was the most significant books, and that's a different.
Yes,
I mean,
that is a different thing.
It is. Mm. Then really, you know, you're not going to include, you know, some 20s romance, you know. I mean, really, you know, to be honest. So that's not to say you don't like it, but that's different from saying it's significant.
Yes.
So I kind of went and talked, and it seemed to go down really well. And I thought, well, that's interesting because I naively thought that kind of everybody sort of had this, you know, sort of, but not everybody does, you know, with, you know, people are sort of led by, you know, obviously the consumerist plugging of books and things, and fine, you know, that's part of their lives, you know, and but, you know, it's quite refreshing perhaps to get a different window into literature for people.
Yeah.
Whenever I've talked about this, people have always been really ordinary people. By that I mean, you know, people that are not writers themselves, you know, that they're just readers. Or, just, you know what I mean? just readers, you know. and, you know, but, you know, who are often more better read than I am. Because as a writer, you don't always have time to read that much. You kind of read the research you have to do. You read maybe something that you think you'll like, but you really don't sort of spend too much time reading, as just readers would, you know, because frankly, you don't have time. So, and also the panoply of voices, there's a critical panoply of voices that you need. And beyond that, it becomes intrusive, I think. You know, it's a bit like, you know, I go to see plays, but I don't get to see them very often, and partly the way my life is. But also, I think if you're actually churning out stuff, the input doesn't have to be enormous. You know, over the years, but not all at once, you know. So, you know, if I went to see 10 plays in a week, I couldn't write a play then, you know, I couldn't write, you know, I'd be sort of completely filled up with, you know, other people's stuff. So there is a kind of fine balance. So I often find readers are actually far better read than I am, which is great, you know, it's fine. I learn from them, you know, and I say, well, tell me about this, tell me about this. So, you know, and we were all readers before we were writers and still are, although once you become a writer, you can never read a book in the same way ever again, because you're always thinking, oh, I wish I'd written that paragraph. Or... he didn't do that so well. That's okay. So I can be better than him, you know. And you're always thinking in this silly, petty way, you know. Or you're thinking kind of, or you're getting ideas, you know, from people in the sense of, you know, you get a wormhole down which you can explore, you know, some little reference to some legend. You think, oh, I'm going to explore that, you know, a little bit. And kind of, and that's what it's about. It's it's a kind of conversation in many different ways. A polyphony, really. You know? We've reached the end of that track.
We have. Maybe we should...
Do you think we've reached the end of all tracks?
The end.